The Speaking of Cults podcast is presented solely for general informational, educational, and entertainment purposes. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from it is at the user's own risk. The views, information, or opinions expressed by the host and guests are solely those of the individuals involved and do not constitute medical or other professional advice. Hello and welcome to the Speaking of Cults podcast. I am very happy to be with you here this week. And it's just you and me this time. And I have brought papers and a little bit of a script this time because I wanted to make sure that I didn't miss anything in this particular episode talking about coercive control, what it is, how it manifests, examples of it, how we can spot it, how it makes us feel. We're going to cover a lot in this show, and I want to be as detail-oriented on this one as I can be, which is why I wrote some bunch of stuff down here. So let's go ahead and just get into it. Coercive control, of course, is defined. Let's go ahead and define it first. It's a pattern of behavior, and I want to be clear that we are talking right from the get-go here. In fact, one of the most important parts of understanding coercive control is understanding that it is a repeating pattern of abusive behavior. It is behavior used by an individual to dominate, manipulate, intimidate, and control another person, often within an intimate or close relationship, but not always. Coercive control manifests across a number of places or in all kinds of spaces that people get involved in, from spousal abuse or domestic partnerships to group situations at work, at clubs, at sports events or teams, at anything that a person is regularly part of, you could say, as a group, and most especially when it is groups that are formed around or very centrally focused around ideological or core value belief system type things, where we see this in ideological political groups, religious activities, lots and lots of that. And of course, we can broaden this out to the entire subject of human trafficking, which utilizes all the methods of coercive control to victimize and abuse people for power and money. The same kinds of methods and techniques are also utilized when in a domestic or spouse relationship or in a cult relationship, okay? It is mostly used as a term, by the way, in the space of domestic abuse. That's where you will most hear the term coercive control. Other places or other spaces tend to use other terminology for it, but this is changing over time as we spread the use of these concepts and words beyond just domestic or spousal abuse. Coercive control involves a range of tactics. It is not one or two or three things. Almost any behavior can be utilized to manipulate, control a person or another or a group of people. And any kind of behavior that is used that way would fall under the idea here of coercive control. It undermines the victim's autonomy, their self-esteem, and their independence, creating a dynamic of power and control in the relationship that is imbalanced. And this has to be understood as a purposeful, premeditated activity. One does not fall accidentally into coercively controlling another human being. This is not something that is an accident. This is not a mistake that somebody makes. It is a calculated campaign of activities that manipulate and control people around them from the perpetrator, from the controller. Now, in terms of, and I wanted to go right into this right away, because there are a number of categories of tactics that are utilized by people who do this, starting with isolation. According to the person who actually coined the term, the recently deceased Evan Stark, isolation, manipulation, and control are your three basic elements of coercive control. So isolation, obviously, we start with that. The perpetrator may gradually isolate the victim from friends, family, and support networks, making them dependent solely on the perpetrator for social interaction and validation. An example of this might be perpetrators who gradually isolate their partner by discouraging them from spending time with family or friends. They could criticize the victim's friends, making derogatory remarks about them or implying that they're a bad influence. Over time, the victim may feel compelled to distance themselves from their social circle to avoid the conflict that comes with the controlling personality. This can be start very slow. This can snowball over time. It could start with critical remarks or statements and build up eventually to dominating, screaming, yelling about how the victim must not be part of that group, associate with that person, have that friendship anymore, be part of that club. It is an effort to isolate. By basically blowing up the person's social networks, professional life, or anything else that needs to be blown up so as to maintain a complete dominating control over the target or over the victim. And this, by the way, it needs to be noted right away, so I will also lead with this, that this is not a gender-specific activity. Any human being can coercively control another human being. Gender actually has absolutely nothing to do with the behavior. The tendency to engage in this behavior appears to be more prominent among males, especially in domestic partnerships, but that's a statistical point and not really relevant to the individual problems that you and I might face in our own lives. Statistically speaking, females may not be the ones who dominate relationships or dominate groups or dominate, you know, cults. That doesn't mean that they can't or that you won't run into a female who will do that to you. So it's important that we keep those statistics in perspective. Coercive control is something that can happen to anyone at any time in almost any situation. Now, another tactic utilized by perpetrators of coercive control beyond isolation is monitoring and surveillance. This involves a constant monitoring of the victim's activities, such as tracking their movements, checking their communications, and demanding detailed explanations for their whereabouts. It's not enough that you were out with friends. What friends? Where? When? What were you doing? If you're making plans for the future, it's going to be very carefully interrogated as to who these people are, where you're going, how long you're going to be gone, what you're going to be doing. To the point of invasiveness, this is not just a casual curiosity from a caring partner or friend. This becomes a bit of an interrogation. And especially, again, over time, these are things that tend to build over time. It starts subtly and grows as more and more control is sort of, as the relationship becomes more used to this new power dynamic, the amount of control that's exerted over the victim becomes greater. For example, now here are some examples of how this might manifest in some of what you might have seen or experienced yourself. A perpetrator may install tracking apps on their partner's phone without their knowledge, allowing them to monitor their movements at all times. They might also demand access to the victim's email or social media accounts, insisting on reading their messages and monitoring their interactions. This constant surveillance creates a sense of fear and anxiety in the victim, knowing that their every move is being scrutinized. Of course, partners or friends can keep tabs on each other, can mutually agree without coercion to have tracking apps or to share information or to be open about, you know, what they're posting or saying or who they are meeting with. But when it becomes, how should I say this? Overbearing. when it is imposing or impinging on your own sense of privacy, when your own sense of identity, your own sense of self, to have somebody else constantly watching everything you're doing and demand accountability for every act you've engaged in, then you may possibly be crossing over into coercive control territory. So it has everything to do with willingness and with fear and anxiety. All right, another tactic utilized here is manipulation and gaslighting. And we're all familiar with, or so many people are now, with this term gaslighting. But we're going to be very specific here in talking about gaslighting because this is a word that tends to be grossly misused these days in the same way that terms like narcissism are grossly misused. And because they are overused and they become watered down and the true meaning of these terms becomes lost in the shuffle. And so I want to be clear here that gaslighting, like coercive control, is not an accident. It's not a one-off. It's not a lie. It's not a deception. Gaslighting is more than that. It is a repeating pattern of deceptive behavior in order to create mental unrest and uncertainty in the target, to get them doubting their own reality and sense of self, so that they have to give over control of their very personality and sense of reality to the perpetrator, to the controller, to the partner, the cult leader, if you will. Any of these contexts utilize gaslighting routinely to make a person doubt their own reality and sense of self. The perpetrator here, in the case of exerting coercive control and manipulation, may distort reality, manipulate facts, or deny their abusive behavior, making the victim doubt their own perceptions and memories. This is also key, is by messing with people's heads in terms of their ability to remember things. Gaslighting can lead the victim to question their very sanity or feel like they are at least overreacting to the situation. Some examples of this might include engaging in repeatedly denying abusive behavior or shifting blame onto the victim. If the victim confronts the perpetrator about their controlling behavior, they may respond by saying things like, "You're overreacting," or "You're imagining things. I've never done that." Over time, the victim may begin to doubt their own perceptions and reality. And finally, and not finally, but also moving on here, there are threats and intimidation. And this is where the gloves come off. This is where it becomes more obvious. And this tends to be middle, late stage sort of behavior on the part of coercive controllers when it comes to actual blatant threats and intimidation. But believe me, these behaviors come out before too long, and they can be quite dominating. They can use threats of violence, harm to loved ones, or other forms of intimidation to maintain control and compliance over the victim. And this could even include threats towards pets or animals or possessions, not just other people. A perpetrator may use threats of violence to intimidate their partner into compliance. For example, they may say things like, "If you leave me, I'll make sure you never see the kids again." Or, "I'll ruin your reputation if you try to leave." These threats instill fear in the victim, making them feel powerless and trapped in the relationship, which is exactly what they are. And that's exactly the point of these kinds of threats, is to maintain dominance over the person. Perpetrators may use their physical size or strength to intimidate and control the victim. This could involve threats of violence or physical aggression, such as blocking the victim's path, invading their personal space, or using physical force to assert dominance. And let's take a look here, for example, at social groups or clubs or activities where you have a leader or certain members who are a bit aggressive, a bit dominating, a bit in your face. Such people can become very powerful in groups because nobody else speaks out against them because they're too afraid to. And they can tend to be very dominating. They can even take control over groups. It's not always the leader who is the dominating force. It could be some member rises up, takes control, and is exerting coercive control to do so. The perception of physical superiority reinforces the power imbalance in the relationship and can make the victim feel powerless to resist. There is also specifically financial abuse, and this is rampant in domestic partnership situations, but it also very much exerts itself in group situations. This involves controlling the victim's access to financial resources, such as money, credit cards, or employment, making them financially dependent on the perpetrator. And here we can even look to groups like Scientology, which demand that you make advance payments towards your next services or groups of services that you're going to do, whether it's Scientology auditing or training. And that sort of puts you in the control of, or at least under the influence of, the organization that you have paid money to, because this could then go into a sunk cost fallacy, quite literally, where because you have paid so much money into a thing, you feel you must stick it out, stay with it, keep going, even though it is not really helping you, it is actually actively harming your life. Now, as far as some other examples here, we might have a perpetrator controlling all the finances in the relationship, giving the victim little to no access to money or resources. This is very common, a lot more common than you might imagine. They might withhold funds for basic necessities, such as food or clothing, or prevent the victim from working or having their own income. The last thing a domestic partner who is abusive wants is for their victim to be financially independent, because then they can just get up and walk out anytime. The financial dependency also makes it difficult for the victim to leave because they will fear that they're unable to support themselves or their children. They may also restrict access to other things, not just money, but also vehicles, passports, identification, use of technology, making it difficult for them to seek help or connect with support networks outside the relationship. There is emotional abuse, and this is a constant component of coercive control. It heavily, heavily leverages our emotional needs against us. The perpetrator becomes familiar with the victim, becomes familiar with their habits and patterns, and with their emotional makeup. In fact, they kind of study that very carefully in getting to know their victim. What are their hates? What are their fears? What are their likes? What are their dislikes? I'm drawing that right out of Hubbard in Scientology, because that's how they determine how to best victimize somebody, is they find out those things. Well, it's very far from L. Ron Hubbard, who came up with that idea. Coercive controllers do that sort of thing all the time. They're trying to find out what it is that drives their victim so that they can set up all the landmines around those emotional needs and thereby control the person. Emotional manipulation, verbal degradation, and demeaning behavior are common tactics to undermine the victim's self-esteem and confidence. The perpetrator may exhibit extreme jealousy or possessiveness, constantly monitoring the victim's interactions with others, questioning their loyalty or love or dedication, becoming angry or suspicious if they spend time away. They may engage in further emotional abuse by constantly criticizing and belittling the victim. They might call them names, insult their intelligence or appearance, or undermine their accomplishments. They may also play the victim or portray themselves as the sole source of support and stability in the victim's life, making it difficult for the victim to assert their own needs or desires. This can be quite overwhelming. It's all about the other person. And any time, you know, your own needs and wants come up, oh, those are always in the back seat. We'll get to those later. Right now, it's important to my needs and wants, right? This is the perpetrator talking. So yeah, this emotional degradation chips away at the victim's self-esteem and makes them more vulnerable to the perpetrator's control. It is this, and this again is a way of how they enact the power imbalance. Is it's all about them. It's never about you as the victim. And finally, we have privilege as a manipulative tactic or strategy. The perpetrator may assert their superiority or entitlement in the relationship, demanding special treatment or privileges while restricting the victim's freedoms and choices. Perpetrators may leverage their social status or reputation to manipulate and control the victim. They might use their influence within social circles or communities to discredit the victim, spread rumors or lies about them, or manipulate others into siding with them against the victim. This can be particularly effective in situations where the perpetrator holds positions of authority, making it challenging for the victim to challenge their behavior or seek support. And this is something that we can see rampant on social media as well. So this is behavior that tends to be more common than you might imagine until you start looking for it. All right, the personality traits now. When we look to why is it that people would do this to other people? What would motivate somebody to dominate other people? Why would that be a tactic or a strategy that they would find useful or pleasing to them? Well, it's not all just about sadism or the narcissism. It's not just about those two things. There can be other things going on, but it tends to fall under that umbrella quite a bit. Now, obviously, narcissism or psychopathy is a motivational force that drives people to coercively control other people. There's a lack of empathy, an inflated sense of self-importance, and a manipulative nature are often seen in narcissists and psychopaths. This is absolutely true. It's how they manage to get through life. We call them predators. It's a better term than narcissist or psychopath because not all narcissists are actually malignant or controlling or dominating. Some narcissists just want to be left alone. Some narcissists never engage in coercive control. They're just all about themselves. But predators, as a term, very clearly are people who are victimizing and dominating other human beings or even, you know, hurting them. So rather than use narcissist or psychopath, I think predator fits better. There is also, and this can also come from people who are not narcissistic predators, but there can be such mental insecurity and uncertainty that the person feels the only way that they can have a healthy relationship or a healthy social standing in their estimation is to engage in this dominating and manipulative behavior. They may feel insecure about themselves or their relationships, or they may feel that in the past they have been dominated and controlled, and so now it's time to turn the tables on the world, and they're going to be the ones in charge, and they're going to be the ones calling the shots, and to hell with anybody who has anything to say otherwise. And they might find that this behavior is not necessarily socially acceptable, and so they have to dial it down a little bit, and then become a bit more covert in the way that they go about their domination because they haven't given up the goal. They just gave up the more aggressive, overt methods or forms of that. And so they'll fall back to more deceitful, manipulative tactics. But they do this out of a sense of intense insecurity and uncertainty about themselves, probably due to past traumas. There is also just straight up entitlement, as we talked about earlier. They just simply feel that they have the right to dictate how their partner or associate should behave. This can be a result of upbringing. This can be a result of religious beliefs. This can be a result of ideological beliefs. It is not a statement of criticism of religion as a subject or politics as a subject to recognize that some people don't do so well in those arenas. And sometimes those topics can be the source of intense, extreme belief to the point where the belief becomes more important than the human beings that the belief or activity or actions exerted on them, right, by those beliefs, that the beliefs are more important than the people. The beliefs become dogmatic. They become cult-like. And when you are crossing lines toward the direction of hurting people or even killing people because of those beliefs, that would definitely be the definition of privilege, wouldn't it? Because you're putting your own needs and desires and beliefs wholly above the livelihood and survival of anyone around you. That would be privilege. And of course, there are simply manipulative personalities. They're not necessarily people who are trying to destroy or kill or hurt, but they end up doing so through their manipulations. There are people who just get off on controlling other people. It's a strange and interesting personality problem, quirk, you could say. Now, recognizing the red flags of coercive control is crucial for people. I've given some examples today already of how you might see this behavior manifest, but there are also things that can happen to a victim over time that can tell them or clue them off that maybe they're in a situation that they shouldn't be in, or a relationship they shouldn't be in, or they've joined a group that they very much should not be part of. And they can tell this not from necessarily just the behavior of others, but how they feel when thinking with or involved with that person or group. For example, feeling fearful or anxious around a partner or friend or group, especially when anticipating their reaction to certain actions or decisions. Feeling isolated from friends, family, or support networks due to a partner's influence. If you suddenly look up one day and realize that you haven't talked with your family in a year or two, and you used to be talking with them all the time, or you haven't visited any other friends lately, you've just been sort of cloistered around at home, this kind of thing, it can be a red flag. Experiencing a loss of autonomy and independence in decision-making, finances, or personal activities. There is nothing that the coercive controller wants more than to create codependency in their victims. They want that person to be utterly reliant on them as the controlling force for every little thing. Constantly walking on eggshells or feeling like you need to tiptoe around the other person's mood or demands. Perpetrators may exhibit unpredictable mood swings, alternating between charm and affection one moment and anger or aggression the next. This roller coaster of emotions can keep the victim off balance and unsure of how to act or respond, further reinforcing the perpetrator's control. And finally, experiencing a significant shift in personality, self-esteem, or confidence since entering the relationship. And again, domestic relationship, group relationship, same. How do you feel about it? And how do you feel about it over time? And can you remember or recall good moments in the same volume or number as bad? There should be more. There should be a lot more moments of good, survival, happy, joyous experiences in any relationship, or certainly not harmful, damaging, destructive events or arguments or insults and this kind of thing. So what's the balance there? In a coercive situation, it is always unbalanced. There is always more bad than there is good. There is more negative than there is positive. And yet it can take an awful lot of honest looking and examining to be willing to acknowledge that. Because again, that codependency component is important. The coercive controller wants the victim to feel dependent utterly and completely on the perpetrator. So they will create all kinds of mental, psychological landmines that the victim has to walk around so carefully to not have go off, that they might just feel so exhausted by having to exert all that energy all the time doing that, that they just don't even want to go there, and they just sort of, okay, fine. And they just put up with things, and they become habituated to putting up with things that they never would have agreed to when the relationship first started, or outside of the relationship, they wouldn't put up with anybody doing this to them. But they will in the relationship, again, whether it's a cult or a group or a club or an individual that a person is in a relationship with. So, if you suspect that you are a victim of coercive control, there are steps you can take to protect yourself. First, number one, is reach out for support. And obviously, watching podcasts like this, getting educated, that kind of thing, very, very supportive. Talk to trusted friends, family members, or professionals who can provide support and help you assess your situation objectively. And that's really important, because we can lose sight of objectivity when we get involved in very emotionally impactful relationships, where we're in love with someone, or we are in a state of awe and euphoria over a cult leader or his methods or techniques or this new diet or this new method or this new thing that you're signed up for. And it's all so thrilling and also exciting. And isn't this the best of all possible worlds? And we can be very, very reluctant to want to question that, or want to think maybe this isn't everything it's cracked up to be. And that is necessary that we do that reflection, though, when we are feeling like we're walking on eggshells, when we feel like things aren't so great, when we feel like, I don't know that this is, when we start having all these questions and concerns, that is the time to really seriously take the rose-colored glasses off and take a good hard look at the situation. And that often will require the help of outside observers like friends, family, etc., or obviously professionals. Now, if you find you're in a situation where there is coercive control being exerted against you, it is important that you document the abuse. Keep a record of any abusive incidents, including dates, times, and details of what happened. Just even if you had to keep it in a little notepad you keep in your back pocket with a little pencil, and you just make little notes here and there in, hidden away from the abuser, you obviously would not be wanting to do these things or do this documentation overtly, challengingly, right in the face of the controller. That could ramp it up and make the abuse go from psychological to physical, or worse, and bring even more issues and abuse down on you. So, but documentation is important. It can be helpful if you decide to seek legal protection or support, or if you want to make a case to even friends or family, if you feel that's necessary, as well as to law enforcement. Sometimes the people in the social circle around the controlling personality are so sold on what a great person that controlling, dominating predator is, that they would never imagine that behind closed doors, this person is a psychological or even physical abuser. And I need to stress that coercive control, of course, is not just physical abuse. It's all this psychological stuff and controlling, dominating, real world stuff that goes on. As well as documenting the abuse, you also want to create a safety plan. And this is actually for real. Plan ahead for how you will respond to abusive situations, including identifying safe places to go and people to contact in case of emergency. This is the exact opposite of what the controlling predator wants. They're trying to isolate and manipulate the person and cut ties off with any social network or support system. So maintaining or creating, even on a covert level, other social network support systems, super important, and something that one can plan for over time. Of course, seeking professional help. Someone can consider seeking support from a therapist or counselor to help process the experiences, rebuild self-esteem, and develop coping strategies. That could be that sometimes you just need a trained professional to help you out with that. Also, and this can be particularly difficult for people, but this is a real this is a real important one in terms of actions to take, and that is knowing your rights in the first place. It's unfortunate but true that a great many people, especially those raised in semi-authoritarian or authoritarian environments where a great deal of control was exerted on them as children, such people have a real hard time with independent thinking or with being their own person. And they don't know that they have rights. They have civil rights. They have human rights. These are things that are acknowledged internationally, but are not always acknowledged in specific churches or groups or cults. And it can be, and a person can be convinced or made to believe that they don't have any rights, or that their rights are only granted by the controlling, manipulative predator. That the only thing they have going for them is this person in their life, and they need to do anything and everything to keep that person happy and keep that person front and center and raised on a pedestal. So that's not right. That's not a healthy relationship, and that is definitely not good, a good place to be in terms of mental health. Codependency and dominating personalities and this kind of thing are the last thing that anyone needs in their life in order to have a healthy relationship or have a healthy mental outlook. And finally, of course, the last thing that you can do if you find out that you're in a situation like this is end the relationship. Just move on. Ultimately, and this is can be a hard message to get across to people sometimes when they are in a situation like this, but ultimately your safety and well-being are paramount. If the coercive control continues despite your efforts to address it, consider ending the relationship and seeking support to rebuild your life. It is important to remember that coercive control is a form of abuse, and no one, not any child, not any woman, not any man, deserves to be subjected to it. Yeah, so if you know someone who is experiencing this, or you yourself are, well, you came to the right place. This is exactly the channel which will have information and tools for you to use to deal with this. And of course, you can contact any trained professionals in your area personally and directly to get one-on-one help. Again, whatever the context, whatever the situation, whatever, you know, however you find yourself the victim of this, you don't have to be. And there is no reason for you to continue to be. You can stop it immediately. And if you can't stop it today, make a plan so that you can stop it tomorrow or the next day or the next as soon as you possibly can. Getting out from under financial domination and emotional, psychological abuse and gaslighting is hard. No one ever said that any part of this is going to be easy. It is emotionally taxing, even exhausting. It can be financially draining. It can tear apart your life, your professional life, your personal life. It can feel horrible. And that's all emanating from and coming from the predator, making your life that way. So the faster you can get away from that and do something about it, the better. And no matter how small it is that you think you can do something, it's better than nothing, right? Any step forward, any step away from this is a positive step. So don't let that overwhelm or the emotional devastation of this experience make you quit or stop or give up, because it is possible to move on from a coercive relationship or situation, get your life back, pick yourself back up, and move on as an independent thinker and operator in your own life, creating your own path forward. That is where I would like to see you. That's where I'd like to see everybody in life, right? And so I hope that this information today helped enable you to do that. That was the point. All right. And with that, I will see you guys next week. Thank you very much for coming and listening to this. I hope it was useful, informative, educational, and entertaining. And on that, I will see you next week. Bye-bye.